So, for tonight, we were bringing this Buddhist Action Month to an end, and we decided during Buddhist Action Month that the best way to complement it, really, on these Monday nights was to talk about the Bodhisattva ideal. And the Bodhisattva ideal is a way that people in time, or a group of people in particular, decided to practice Buddhism. Yep. And it was in the Mahayana is where the Bodhisattva ideal comes from. The Mahayana points in the same way to the goal of enlightenment as all the other forms of Buddhism. But in particular, it highlights beauty and it highlights other regard. Yeah, so altruistic action, practicing for the sake of others. And it's that which really defines the Bodhisattva ideal. And so tonight I volunteered to kind of wrap it all up. So I actually introduced it about 4 weeks ago. And then over a period of 3 weeks, we had three great speakers talking about the different perfections. So Natalie talked on generosity and skillful action. And then Erica talked on energy and patience. And then Akampia last week talked on dhyana and wisdom, or concentration and wisdom. And I'm wrapping it up. So as I was thinking about it, I think I wouldn't necessarily say, and some of you will chuckle, but I wouldn't necessarily come up with a definitive talk in a certain way tonight, which won't be that different from how I sometimes talk. But what I was thinking about and what I'd like to share with you is sort of some of the reflections I had on the bodhicitta, you know, on this kind of, well, on the bodhicitta. So to start with, what I'd like to do is I'd just like to talk to you about watershed points. Yeah? This is how I started thinking about it, was this watershed points. So a watershed point is an important, sometimes historical event where you get change, where change happens. And this could be in your personal life. It could be, like I said, political or social, or it could be a critical point in a war. And literally, the watershed point is the difference where kind of water lands from the sky and it goes in two separate directions. In one direction, it goes to one body of water, and in the other direction, it goes the other. So in America, classic, really distinct watershed ridge is the Rocky Mountains. And to the east of the Rocky Mountains, all the water flows into the Mississippi. To the west of the Rocky Mountains, it all flows Pacific Ocean. And the Mississippi, of course, empties out through New Orleans. There's a huge delta there. It's a huge floodplain because of all the water that feeds into the Mississippi Valley. And it feeds into the Gulf, really, which then connects up with the Atlantic. So that's like literally watershed. But historically, you know, some of the watershed points that have happened historically. I was thinking about D-Day in World War II, and actually it really made me quite sad, but sad and kind of happy at the same time, or grateful, maybe, because on D-Day, the Allies had been pushed out of Europe completely, and they had to regain a foothold in Europe in order to advance against Germany. And so they decided to land on this particular beach, and the weather conditions weren't favorable, but they decided they had to do it anyways on that particular day. And the German casualties were 1,000 men, but the Allied casualties were about 10,000 on that day. You know, they were just charging kind of a beach to try and take it. You know, the people that got shot down just outright would have been high. But you could say that was a historical turning point, because it was with the Allies gaining a foothold back on European soil that the tide of the war started to change. Yeah, and that watershed point wasn't a pleasant one, you know, not pleasant as an event, but but significant and necessary. Yeah. There was also thinking about more favorable turning points in history. I immediately thought of the mass conversions of Dr. Ambedkar in India. So Dr. Ambedkar, we're actually going to hear a little bit about Dr. Ambedkar next week from Sujiva. But I'm not going to fill out the details. But Dr. Ambedkar was a civil rights leader in India. He was very significant because what he did was he decided that the Hindu religious system, in particular the Hindu caste system, was a belief system that was oppressive. And it was oppressive to everybody in the untouchable classes, in the lower classes of Hinduism. And he realized that until people realign themselves to a different religious belief, if they stayed Hindus, they would be forever shackled by that belief system. And so it was a real major turning point politically and socially in India when there was a mass conversion. Dr. Ambedkar converted first, and then he converted personally 600,000 people on that particular day. So 500,000 people, you know. And after that, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, probably over 1 million or 2, converted to Buddhism out of the Hindu caste system. So that was a major turning point. Similarly, I was thinking that we've got turning points in our lives, don't we? There are points in our lives where something happens. And I was thinking of births and deaths in particular. And one thing that came to mind was when I was 18, my uncle committed suicide. And at the same, like within a week, my a very, very good family friend who was 18 had a fatal car accident. So as an 18-year-old, 17 maybe, I was just like, I did not know how to respond to that. I was really confused because a 17, 18-year-old kid had had their life taken away, and a 60-year-old man had taken his own life. And I was a mathematician, so I thought, well, why don't we just shuffle lives around? 18-year-old keeps their life, and the 60-year-old could die in an accident, you know? And I sort of realized, oh, it doesn't work that way, does it? You know? And, but, you know, that kind of like, that was a turning point for me, because I just sort of realized that, well, I guess in some ways I realized life wasn't fair. It didn't correspond the way I thought it should. And, you know, there's something in there that really turned. And sometimes you do have moments like that, like around a death or a loss or a birth, where you can really tell that something shifted in your life. But other times, it's like drops in a bucket. And it's not so easy to tell what shifted. You know, it's just like all of a sudden a situation that's really difficult and really painful, just you decide that you're just not going to do it anymore. You just make some choice that you're not going to live that way anymore. Or maybe it's something that's a really positive choice that you've been putting off out of fear. And you think, you know, and you kind of been putting it off, but something accumulates and you decide, no, I'm actually going to do that. And that's a turning point in your life. Maybe it's following a dream. You know, maybe it's calling up a friend you haven't spoken to in a long time and renewing a friendship. I don't know. But sometimes it's just like, it's like an accumulation of drops in a bucket. I was thinking another thing was being comfortable with who we are. Sometimes that's drops in a bucket. Sometimes it's kind of like for a long time in our lives, we're uncomfortable with who we are. And it's just like, it's a slow process of getting comfortable. You know, but once we do, it's a major turning point and things shift. Well, with Buddhism, there's a major turning point too. And I guess the arising of the bodhicitta, which is what we've been exploring, the practices leading to that over the past 4 weeks, the arising of bodhicitta is a way of talking about that major turning point in Buddhism. Yeah. It's a particular way of talking about it. Now, well before that point happens, we kind of smell change, you know, and we even head in that direction. We start making plans for that change. We start realizing that change is necessary. We become more and more dissatisfied maybe with how things are. And we start realizing that the basis on which we've been making choices hasn't been leading to our happiness. Or maybe it's the sense that somehow there's more happiness to be had. You know, but there's a smell that starts to happen. There's a kind of a sense of something possible well before this turning point. But when this turning point happens, there's a decisive shift. And there's different languages for it. So one of the ways that this decisive seeing through is talked about in Buddhism is in terms of stream entry, which we've talked about on Monday nights here. Stream entry is a metaphor of momentum. Yeah, it's a metaphor of the momentum whereby before you were kind of like you weren't being carried along by things. But when you get in the stream, you're carried along by the stream. So it's stream entry is like a metaphor of almost like will, you know? Or it's another way of talking about will, that once you kind of gain stream entry, you're kind of carried along by it. The other one that they talk about is turning about at the greatest seat of consciousness, which Acampia referred to last week. It's this turning point where somehow something inside you that seemed to be upright is inverted so that it actually is upright, because actually it was turned over before. You know, it was kind of like facing the wrong direction, and now all of a sudden it's facing the right direction. And that facing in the right direction is associated with an immense sense of liberation. But there is really, truly this feeling that you're somehow turned inside out. But in turning yourself inside out, or in something, you know, doing that, by it turning about at the greatest seat, the feeling is not one of being turned inside out, but being turned right side up. Yeah? Of being kind of put upright. Yeah? And you get that metaphor in the Pali Canon from the Buddha. You know, the Buddha talks about, people talk about all the time, of like, where there was darkness, there's now light. You know, what was knocked over is now turned upright, is put upright. The arising of the bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakening. And citta is another word for that which is conscious. So it's like another word for mind or heart. So bodhicitta is a mind intent on awakening. That's literally what it means. But if you look at the literature, and our teacher, Sangharakshita, he talks about it as the will to enlightenment. So he says that citta, mind or heart, is kind of not enough to convey the spirit of that word, of what that word actually means in the original language. That you really need to translate it as the will to enlightenment. And it is a will to enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings too, which is an interesting thing, because it doesn't really, that doesn't come in the words literally in the translation. So it's the altruistic dimension of this turning point in Buddhism. It's the dimension that in a way isn't so concerned with the self. So the self clinging has sort of dried up. And you're not concerned about yourself so much. You're not concerned in a way, I don't think, from reading the literature it seems, I don't think you're concerned so much about anything in particular. But what you're concerned about is, say, for example, good with a capital G, you know, in a very broad sense. So what you're concerned about is almost like the sum total of happiness, the sum total of virtue, the sum total of the alleviation of suffering. You're not operating in the world in any sort of limited way, but what you're doing is you're just interested in goodness, you know, in truth, in beauty. You're interested in those. And your mind and your heart is one that can move fluidly in aid of that. And it can move fluidly in aid of suffering. I try to think of an imaginal exercise, and I didn't think of one that I was happy putting you through. Let's put it that way. But I'll tell you what I was thinking, because I was thinking it's a bit like, it's almost as if like, you know, you're in a room that you understand where everything is, yeah? You understand where all the sharp objects are in the room, and you avoid them, yeah? You know where food can be found in that room, and you go and you eat of it. You eat it, yeah? You know where it's comfortable and soft to lie down, and you sleep there, yeah? But if someone else were to come into the room, and they couldn't see any of those things, yeah? And you're watching them kind of bump into sharp objects, and you're watching them not being able to find food and water, and you're watching them not sleep in the soft places, but in the hard places. What would you do? How would you feel towards them?
Compassion.
And what would you do out of that compassion?
Why not talk to them about where they could find anything?
Yeah. And I think the arising of bodhicitta is a bit like that dimension of the Buddhist life. That we, to the extent that we know where the sharp objects are, where the things that are nourishing are, where the soft places to sleep are, we want to share that with other people. Yeah. And in the spiritual life, it's rather subtle sometimes, but we try our darndest to share it with them. And our heart actually breaks when they continue to harm themselves, you know. And I'm not talking from a religious perspective, like, oh, those pitiful kind of Philistines out there. It's not at all what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in a very, very kind of down-to-earth human way. You see it sometimes if you've ever had a family member who's had addiction problems. It's so painful because you know, they can be so talented, so witty, so kind of beautiful in some ways. And yet they're kind of engaging in these habits which lead to their own harm and the harm of people around them. And you don't know what you can do to help, because you know that it's not within your control, it's within their control. Yet at the same time, everything in you wants to help in any way you can. You know? And I guess that somehow with the bodhisattva, the arising of bodhicitta, is not only that immense compassion to help, but also, I think, an ability to help. And that comes out of that lack of getting in the way of being helpful as much as anything else. So when the bodhicitta arises, yourself, which is actually in the way of you helping other people, kind of starts to drop away. So the arising of bodhicitta is more about you becoming more proficient almost at helping other people because you're less self-centered. Yeah. And they talk about, Sangharakshita, our teacher, talks about the bodhicitta as something that arises within a community of people. So it's not something that we own ourselves. It's something that you feel or is more likely to be felt in a community of people that are practicing. And it's sort of like how I imagine it is that when that kind of that thorn of the self isn't getting in the way, then the collaborative team effort actually becomes quite collaborative and quite capable. You know, I mean, when two people are working together and neither of them is kind of got a sense of what has to happen or what can't happen, then they're both empowered to do more easily what needs to happen. And they're going to see more clearly what needs to happen. Yeah? I mean, if for no other reason that two people can see a situation more clearly than one, because there's two perspectives. It's like, cover one of your eyes and try. You don't have any depth perception, right? You need two eyes to have depth perception. So in some ways, having two people gives a bit more depth perception. Having three or four, and you're like a fly, you know, or an insect. You've got like multiple perspectives. And if those perspectives can kind of all be used effectively, then the collaborative kind of ability to respond to suffering increases dramatically. So this watershed point, which is kind of this turning point in Buddhism, you know, which is called the arising of bodhicitta, where I then went with it was kind of like looking at the kind of the complementary terrain, yeah? Because it makes sense. Well, I don't know. It made sense to me what I've just said. So it made sense to everybody else. Hopefully, yeah. So what I start then looking for is when I think of a watershed, I think of, well, the ridge. I think the ridge of the Rocky Mountains. So like when I used to hike in New Hampshire, we used to actually walk along the ridgeline. You could just walk along it. And on your left side, the water went this way. And on your right side, the water went that way. And you could like walk along it. You know, it was really clear. So if Buddhism has these turning points, if we're going to take that metaphor out a bit further, I'm kind of wondering, well, what is the ridgeline? Yeah? Where's the ridgeline here? And basically, the ridgeline seems to be our worldviews and our emotional tendencies. Yep. So the ridgeline is the way we see the world and how we react to that view. So what's interesting here is that our worldview shapes our actions, and then our actions shape our worldview. So we're not dealing with we're not dealing so much with scientific discovery right now, a clean scientific discovery of gravity. We're not dealing with that. What we're dealing with is the realm of quantum physics, where the act of perceiving something changes the event that we're perceiving. So it gets more complicated. Yeah? And the way in which our actions influence what we're perceiving is usually talked about in terms of self-reinforcing prophecies. So like say, for example, the one I'm familiar with that's really kind of clean is there was a Swedish guy wrote a book called The American Dilemma, which was written like in the 40s around the Black American problem. And what he said, and it was actually used by Supreme Court to make affirmative action decisions in America, what he said was that, you know, what you get in some parts of the country is you get people that have a view about how somebody is. They're like this, yeah? They're capable of doing this or they're incapable of doing that. And based on that view they have of that person, they make decisions about how generous they'll be with that person and what they'll allow them to have access to. And then based on the access those people have to those things, such as education, healthcare, and jobs, then that creates kind of the life they live. So you basically say, oh, well, that person isn't capable of learning, so you deny them schooling. And then they grow up to be illiterate. And then you use their illiteracy to say, look, they're not capable of learning. Yeah? You say to somebody, well, actually, those people never take care of themselves, so you deny them health care, which would just be a waste of money because it's not going to benefit anything anyways because they don't take care of themselves. So then their health declines, yeah? And then you say, look, see? You know, that's the way they are. So Gunnar Myrdal pointed this out, and it's a self-reinforcing kind of relationship between the views, the actions, and then it just reinforces the views. And in Buddhism, what the Buddha told us, with that same thing happens, that what it is we've got a view that we exist. We've got a view that we exist and that things around us exist, and that they're permanent and satisfying and substantial. And that if only we grasp the things that are that kind of bring us pleasure and we push away the things that give us pain, that somehow we'll be happy. Yeah? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it works just enough to kind of not break us from that view. Just enough truth to kind of keep us there, and not so much pain that we really kind of ditch it. And but what the Buddha said was that there's a different ridge point. Yeah, what he said was there's a different ridge point, and that ridge point is that instead of following the worldly winds, yeah, instead of kind of following gain and avoiding loss and following pleasure and avoiding pain, that's not the watershed, that's not the ridge for this watershed between kind of our normal life and the bodhicitta. But there's actually a different measure, yeah? And he talked about skillfulness and unskillfulness. He talked about meditation. He talked about concentration. He talked about wise attention. And that was the language used in the Pali Canon for this ridge. Yeah? So if we go back to the Pali Canon, that's what we'll find. We'll find the threefold path, find the precepts. But what we've been exploring over the past 3 weeks is a different description of the ridge. Yeah? A later description of the ridge from the Buddhist tradition. And this description of the ridge not only included skillful and unskillful choices, so it includes the precepts, it includes meditation, it includes dhyana, it includes wise attention, it includes prajna, yeah? But it also included something, it included generosity. Yeah? It included that explicit act of giving, which, in fact, Sangharakshita at one point in time said that generosity, if you want to fall back and cut your spiritual practice back to the very start, yeah, where it all starts is by being generous. That's the very basis of all spiritual practice, you know? So, in the very least, if in any moment we're wondering what to do, the answer is to be generous. And you probably kind of, that'll probably lead you in the right way. So the six perfections take what the Buddha talked about and add generosity. And they also add virya, energy, and patience. And the Buddha talked about these things, but the Buddha didn't maybe make it so explicit as it was later on. You know? So when you talk about the practice of energy, which is something that Erica talked about, you're talking about energy in pursuit of the good. So, excuse me, it's that willingness to keep coming back, to keep showing up in the spiritual life. Yeah? So the whole question of skillful and unskillful, the question of am I present or not present, you know, the question of wise attention, whether I'm actually seeing the world as it really is or not. Those things kind of, they rise and they fall away. Sometimes we're in touch with them, sometimes we're not. But what virya is just that quality of keep showing up to that process, keep coming back to it, you know, just making the effort to kind of show up again, yeah? Which in some cases, the spiritual life, you know, what you might need to do is let go. So virya in those cases means letting go. Because in the West, we hold too tightly sometimes. So virya, wise attention, kind of, well, not wise attention, but energy in pursuit of the good, might be energy which is kind of spacious, relaxed, yeah? Does nothing, steps back, you know? And then you start getting into this other quality that's being introduced with the six perfections, which is patience. And in patience is that, you know, it's the realization that in a way we're not in control of the world around us. That that there are things we have influence over, but there's a lot of things we don't have influence over. Yeah? And that sometimes the things we don't have influence over are painful. Yeah? And so trying to have patience in that. Yeah? Sometimes we want things to change quicker than they do, and they're not changing that quickly. And just having patience, having a bit like Virya, kind of showing up. Just keep showing up. Yeah? Whether that showing up implies active showing up or a patient showing up, but keep showing up. So these six perfections, they are a ridge. They're the ridge line with the Bodhisattva ideal. And if you practice them, yeah, what happens is that the watershed, you know, the kind of this kind of collection of drops in the bucket, which is your spiritual life, starts to accumulate more towards awakening, yeah? And the drops stop accumulating on the other side of the mountain, which is towards samsara and the world. So the drops start accumulating more and more towards awakening, more and more towards spiritual well-being of both yourself and others. Yeah? And that's the choice we're kind of making by practicing these. Now, in the beginning, we can't see the ridgeline. We are like the people in the room that don't know where the sharp objects are. Yeah, we're like the people in the room that don't know where the nourishment is, don't know where the food and the water, don't know where it's soft to sleep. We are the people who are sleeping. Sometimes we sleep on the soft spot. Sometimes we sleep on the hard spot, and we can't quite figure out why. We think it's because somebody else is sleeping in the hard spot or the soft spot and won't let us there, or we don't know. We blame other people. We blame things. We say, oh, this room's no good. We just do all sorts of things. But in fact, we really just don't understand the conditions under which we live. We just don't understand the way it's influencing our happiness. We just don't understand. So the Buddha, I mean, you know, the Buddha's saying, well, look, I understand. Yeah. Sleep here. Yeah? And that's the six perfections. The six perfections are where to place your attention. You know? Because the six perfections are the ridgeline. Yeah? And in the beginning, that is, we have to take that on in faith. Because basically, we can't see. Yeah? And so, we need to kind of start to do the trainings by which we can see for ourselves. Which is what meditation's about. You know, by meditating, you start to see for yourself. And you don't have to believe these things blindly. But you have to realize that you don't see clearly now. And anybody that does meditation for a little while will realize this. Because what will happen is you come to meditation, you start meditating for like 3 months, let's say. In 3 months' time, meditating 15 minutes a day, I guarantee you, you'll start to think that the world's changing around you. You'll think, wow, it's the colors becoming brighter, and it's just like, who put those cobwebs up in the corner of my room? You know? But in fact, what it'll be is you're just waking up to your world. You're becoming more aware of that world. And in that way, too, not only are you becoming more aware of like the cobwebs in the corner, but you're also becoming more aware of the beauty of that world. You're coming more in tune, more sensitive to the beauty of that world. So as you kind of start to do those practices, then you can even test what the Buddha is saying. You can practice patience and you can practice impatience, and you can see what the consequences are. You can see whether it's truly a ridgeline, yeah, or not. You can practice effort in pursuit of good and virtue, or you can practice laziness in pursuit of virtue and good and see what the difference is in your life. You can practice generosity, and you can practice not being generous, and you can see what the effects are in your life. But in a way, you've got to really practice meditation first to open your eyes so you can tell what actually is happening around you, because, you know, it's like all those movies with, you know, eyes shut, like there's a bunch of themes, titles from movies. It's like going through life with eyes shut. And mostly we do. So when these six perfections, as we practice them, And the real point at which the bodhicitta arises is when we're practicing them, and we really do stop. We're not there in the same way, you know. So instead of being obsessed with ourself, that obsession kind of falls away. And they talk about that as sort of it's kind of mixing things, but. The true perfections are kind of only can be practiced when they've got this sense of shunyata, this sense of the open dimension of being that informs them. And that is really that turning about that I've been talking about, is that at some point that turning about happens. And in a way, if you understand conditionality, and that's the Buddha was teaching us about conditionality, what he basically said was that you can't aim for that turning about in a way. It's like what you've got to do is aim for the conditions by which that turning about arises. So it's a bit like with meditation. You can't aim to get into a really concentrated state. What you do is you provide all the conditions by which concentration arises, and then it just happens. So similarly, with the arising of the bodhicitta, it's like we don't pull the bodhicitta out, you know, with tweezers. You know, it just happens. And I think that's why you talk about the arising of the bodhicitta. It's like the sun just rises. It just rises. And all we really have to do is show up in the morning and open our eyes. Yeah? And showing up in the morning and opening our eyes is the practice of the six perfections. So That's kind of my talk for tonight. But I did want to say, I want to plug the next series. Yeah? Because when it comes to six perfections, that's one way of practicing for the arising of the bodhicitta. But another way of practicing for the arising of the bodhicitta is also the brahmaviharas. Yeah? And what we're going to do next on Monday nights, after a couple weeks of other things, is we're going to explore the four brahmaviharas. Yeah? And the brahmaviharas are based off of this a kind of an intention of care and concern for yourself and others. And that care of concern kind of expanding and growing. So we'll be practicing those coming up as another means of helping us practice the six perfections. So with this watershed point, one side of the mountain kind of your being kind of leading to awakening, and the other side of the mountain kind of where you're already at, I really hope that everybody kind of has a bit more, actually makes the choice to kind of go down one side of the mountain rather than the other. And I'm going to end there because I'm just babbling at this point. So.